This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. My guest today is the psychologist, podcaster, and best-selling author, Scott Barry Kaufman, whose new book is Transcend, The New Science of Self-Actualization. Kaufman's book updates Abraham Maslow's famous hierarchy of needs and his theories of personal fulfillment for a time of global pandemic, racial unrest, and hyper-polarized politics. In a wide-ranging conversation, I talk with Kaufman about how self-actualization, the realizing or even exceeding of your personal potential and goals, intersects with contemporary debates about things like Black Lives Matter and racial grievance, growing nastiness and bad faith arguing in partisan politics, and rising rates of depression and anxiety during COVID-19 lockdowns. We also talk about how aspects of Maslow's thought map onto libertarian ideas about autonomy, freedom, and self-fulfillment. Here is The Reason Interview with Scott Barry Kaufman. Scott Barry Kaufman, thanks for talking to Reason.
Oh, Nick, I always love chatting with you.
Okay, so let's get right to it. Give me the elevator pitch of your book.
Oh, I'm not good with elevator pitches because...
Okay, then make it an escalator pitch.
Okay, well...
Moving sidewalk.
Yeah, okay. I'll just get right into it. So I was going to say something and I'm not going to say it. Okay, so the thing with this book is that I really wanted to understand what the latest science of human potential looks like. What does the whole landscape look like? I've been spending the past 25 years of my career studying it from lots of different angles, studying it from like a genetic perspective, from developmental perspective, from social psychological perspective, positive psychology, humanistic psychology. I wanted to bring together all of this into a sort of a unifying framework of some sort. And what really stimulated me to want to do this project was discovering the personal journals and a lot of unpublished stuff that Maslow wrote. And I really fell in love with his writings and his thinking about human potential. It aligned so much with what I was thinking for many years about human intelligence and self-actualization, why we need to kind of think about self-actualization in our school system more and stuff like that. So just it really sang to the deepest recesses of my being.
Can you define? Yeah. I think most of my listeners know who Abraham Maslow is, and they're familiar with the hierarchy of needs, or sometimes the Maslow's pyramid. And you point out in the book, which is I think meaningful, that in fact, you know, Maslow did not talk about a pyramid or a ziggurat. He didn't talk about any geometric shape. But who was Abraham Maslow, and what is self-actualization?
So Abraham Maslow was a humanistic psychologist during a period in the about 50s to 70s. There was this group of humanistic psychologists that were interested in understanding the whole person and the potential of humans for evil, but also for good. They felt like modern day psychology at that time was neglecting the higher reaches of humanity. Freud saw beneath everything just sexual and destructive impulses. That's what he reduced everything to.
Love and death, right?
Love, there you go. Those two things.
Yeah.
And taxes.
Yeah.
The only inevitables.
Which we now understand are optional. Right?
Yeah, now we know. I knew you were going to say that. Yeah. And then also a counter to the stimulus response, kind of Skinner's box. We're all just rats in a Skinner's box, reinforcement. You know, we're that manipulable. There's nothing much going on inside.
So, and these guys are coming out of, I mean, they're coming out of World War II. Many of them are Jewish. Maslow himself is Jewish, but was born and grew up in the U.S., but many of them were escapees from Nazi concentration camps. And these guys, nonetheless, they're looking on the bright side of life, right? Or the potential for humans to be something other than awful and horrible.
Well, I would say they're actually trying to look at a realistic view of humans. See, I would argue that the realistic view incorporates both the potential for evil as well as the potential for goodness. So, for instance, Raoul May, who is one of my influences within the humanistic psychology movement, really believed in this idea of the daimonic, which is whatever it is within us that has the power to overtake the whole person. But he argues it could be the greatest source of our destruction, or it could be the greatest source of our creativity. And it really is up to how we integrate it into the rest of our being. So that's what I like about the humanistic psychologists. And I would actually distinguish humanistic psychology a bit from modern day positive psychology, you know? So
please explain that.
Well, I have a lot of respect for modern day positive psychology. Let me be clear about that. What they've done with Martin Seligman and Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi in 1998, when they Christianed this field, what they did, which humanistic psychology didn't have, was put on a firm scientific foundation. The investigation, they made it like respectable to scientifically study happiness, to study fulfillment, meaning, lots of things that like people like Viktor Frankl were talking about, you know, other, I would consider him a humanistic psychologist as well. All these things people were talking about, but just not put on a firm scientific foundation. But it did focus for many years in that field on happiness, on life satisfaction was like a big construct. It's funny because when you look at the ranks of humanistic psychologists, life satisfaction, that's not really words used a lot. Happiness is not a word used a lot. Achievement, so the science of achievement is big in positive psychology now. That's actually not a word that was used a lot among the humanistic psychologists, achievement. The two words that were used the most were health and growth. And, you know, having healthy, making healthy choices, having healthy motivations, and growing and actualizing your potentials.
So talk about self-actualization then, you know, kind of fill out that concept. What is it, and how did Maslow kind of come to characterize it?
So when Maslow first started writing about this topic in his theory of motivation in the 40s, he really was co-opting this term Kurt Lewin was using, self-actualization, and he meant it more broadly. Kurt Lewin just meant it as with brain damaged patients, certain areas of the brain would take over, and it almost seemed like the brain was wired to actualize its potential no matter what. And but Maslow generalized it to just mean whatever it is within us that is uniquely within us that we most, you know, can contribute to the world, you know, the kind of sacred part of our being, you know, what is the thing that makes you, not just you, a human? Because he talks about a lot of basic needs that are, we share with other humans. So if you have the need for security, if you're hungry, that's a very human thing. If you connection, self-esteem, we all want a certain self-esteem. It's one of those things like, you know, it doesn't make you terribly special if you say, I really like to be respected. You know, it's like, well, who doesn't, buddy?
Right.
But if you say I can play an amazing violin concerto, or I can, you know, host a Reason podcast like no one else, you know, then you're talking about how Nick is self-actualizing. So I think that's how he saw it in his first earlier writings about it. But he shifted his thinking about self-actualization quite considerably, particularly the last couple years of his life, where he started to argue there were two types of self-actualizers. There were the transcenders, and there were the the non-self transcending self-actualizers. And he actually distinguished between the two.
What are they, and you know, why is that important for you and the book Transcend?
So now, a lot of people might not realize, but towards the end of his life, he proposed a motivation that was higher than the need for self-actualization. Proposed the need for transcendence, having peak experiences in life, fusing with the B values. He called them the values of pure being. There are values that we don't do them as a means to an end in something else. We do them as important ends in themselves. The beauty, meaning in the world, meaningfulness, justice, goodness, a whole wide range of these sorts of B values. He had created a whole list. And he just really, he did see these transcenders as being really motivated by something other than just the actualization of their own potential. They often tend to be motivated by wanting to increase the potential of society or the good society, maximize the potential of humans. And And so he distinguishes these two types of self-actualizers. I think it's very interesting.
How Maslow was writing about this stuff and kind of pushing his thought to, you know, its ultimate limits in the late 60s. And he obviously, you know, just as you're talking about this, a lot of this stuff, you know, fits very well with what was going on in American society, where people at all levels were kind of rebelling against consumer cult comforts. Not they were starting to look for deeper meanings, more kind of, I mean, you know, America had an existential crisis on a certain level, where it became more important. You know, things became more important than simply having a lot of money or being successful in a career ways, or, you know, some kind of secular success. Was Maslow a driver of that understanding as much as he reflected, you know, that kind of tendency in America? No. And is that mostly a shift from a kind of scarcity society where we were trying to cover our basic wants to a society where we had more leisure time, more income? To kind of think about stuff.
Yes, I think Maslow perfectly was placed in that time period, and caught the wind of the hippie 60s. Mm-hmm. They took his ideas and ran with it. You know, that's what usually happens in these kinds of things. It's not like the person set out or meant to be a cultural icon. You know, it's not like there are a lot of people who want to be cultural icons. They don't become old cultural. It usually is. The moment captures that person, you know, and seizes upon that person and uses it. And so, for instance, Esalen Institute, which is a big part of that time period, they wanted to create this human potential movement. For instance, Michael Murphy, one of the co-founders of Esalen, who I talked to this day, I talk to him, and some people credit him with the start of the human potential movement. He loved Maslow, and Esalen was founded on its love of some of those humanistic psychologists from that time, and they would invite, you know, some of them over to Esalen to give talks.
Right.
The idea, you know, with the war and the idea of like peace and love, that just sat so well with like even Carl Rogers' notion of unconditional positive regard, and it really caught that moment. So yeah, I think that your question is a very interesting question, and I think that you just have to look at it within the ecosystem of that time period and realize that people were craving human potential at that time within themselves. They were,
oh God, it's amazing when you, you know, in reading, I thought I knew about Maslow pretty well, and your book is a real revelation about his life as well as his work and thought. But, you know, a guy who was born in the early 20th century in New York City to Jewish emigres, refugees from anti-Semitism and whatnot in Europe, grows up under kind of tough circumstances.
He was bullied a lot. Anti-Semitism.
Yeah, and then, you know, goes to City College, University of Wisconsin in Madison, comes back and, you know, to New York eventually and other places. And he's talking about a life that is beyond just kind of covering the bases. And of course, I think American society coming out of the Depression, coming out of World War II, certainly, you know, and then this massive economic boost where, you know, a broad-based rise in incomes, education, and kind of wondering of why we're here. It's fascinating. Oftentimes, people like Maslow or the human potential movement, certainly places like Esalen, are kind of mocked or critiqued for giving rise to the 70s and what Tom Wolfe called the me decade, a kind of decade of, you know, narcissism or individualism, not even individualism, but solipsism, kind of run wild, that got its ass kicked by the go-go 80s, right? Because then suddenly we all wanted cars, big cars, and Armani suits and, you know, fancy clothes again. Can you walk through why there seems to be a resurgence in this kind of humanistic thinking nowadays? Because it definitely seems to be the case that the type of work you're doing, things like positive psychology and the human potential movement, are seeing a renaissance or a resurgence in interest.
Yeah, I think that's a really astute observation. So let's get into this, because you ask a really important question that I wouldn't even begin to say that I have the answers, but I have some observations, I'd be curious to see what you think of some of this. But it seems like right now we're living in an age where people are socially being rewarded for expression, you know, in a way like the 60s again, you know, where, you know, it's very cool now to be LGBTQ, you know, plus. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's there's a societal
to be different.
There's
saying like to be unique and not like everyone else.
Yes. Now, one could say that, I mean, kind of who you ask, you know, people think that's either a great thing or a terrible thing. I'm not mm-hmm. here to, right. I'm giving a social observation. I'm not here to, I want to stand all above all that for a moment, just to discuss all this. So a lot of people are feeling empowered to really, you know, come out and express their, a status that they feel has been marginalized for a really long time. And we're seeing that en masse and people, and there's also like a social reward structure now for expressing vulnerability, for expressing victimhood, even, you know, expressing coming out and saying, you know, I was traumatized, you know, and people are more encouraging and seem to be very understanding of that, as long as it's a certain kind of being traumatized. Like, I mean, if you're a white male and you say I'm traumatized by black people, you don't get, you know what I'm saying? You know, that's not a very popular thing to say.
Right.
But, you know, but one could really, you know, just look at this moment and say, well, you know, this is you know, from a certain perspective, this is a beautiful thing that a lot of people for a long time in our society who they would say they've been systemically oppressed are getting this opportunity to once and for all finally have a moment, you know, and be appreciated. I mean, everywhere I walk in LA, I see Black Lives Matter on graffitied everywhere, stores on the front. I mean, everywhere I walk, I see Black Lives Matter. That's got to mean something to black people, right? To a lot of people who have felt as though they've been ignored, that they haven't mattered. So that's a big deal, I think. I think this is a big deal, this cultural moment. So I do think there's something there about, we're seeing this kind of resurgence again of, you know, in the 60s, there was that spirit of free love, right? Free sex. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not saying in the same way now you're saying it, but in that same way of where there's this.
So, there was an opening up and an appreciation of individualism of people who belong to marginalized groups finally being able to express themselves, being able to be visible.
Yeah.
You know, what's going on now? Do you see, though, you know, because in your book, one of the things that you talk about on the road to kind of self-actualization and transcending kind of the limitations and the parts of ourselves that are kind of ugly and grubby and kind of drag not just us down, but the people around us down, because there's, you know, seems to be some comfort in, you know, in nobody succeeding. If you're not succeeding, it's, you know, there seems to be an impulse to pull other people down. So, you know, on the one hand, you're talking about self-actualization and growth and a recognition that we're all different and that we all have equal status and being coming out of a humanistic tradition. But then you also talk about a grandiose and vulnerable narcissism as kind of phenomenon that track with a lot of what Maslow was talking about and actually warning against too. How does the manifestation of narcissism in those forms, how is that distinct from a positive kind of growth of the self towards self-actualization?
I feel like I know what Maslow would say if he were alive today, and and in a lot of ways, I feel like I try to channel that that way of thinking. You know, I think it's really unfair to blame people like Maslow and Carl Rogers for the self-esteem movement that happened in the 70s. You know, the Smalley, you know, the whole Saturday Night Live skit, all that.
Right. Yeah, and this is the, you know, it's funny you know, when people denounce participation trophies, you know, for kids, you know, and I don't know about you. I mean, I was born in 1963, and all of the trophies I ever got, they were all participation trophies. So this is a pretty old phenomenon, actually, of just, you know, you get a lollipop just for showing up. But that self-esteem movement, the idea, oh, you know, you're great just the way you are. You know, you don't have to be smart. You don't have to be pretty. You don't have to be accomplished. just, you don't even have to show up sometimes.
That's actually the opposite of what the humanistic psychologists were pushing.
Right.
You know, they were so into people having critical self-examination and self-honesty and looking at their deficiencies and looking to see how much they're motivated by their deficiencies versus how much are they motivated to grow. You know, the whole self-esteem movement is not about growth. It's about defensive narcissism of like making sure that, you know, don't ever think thoughts that might suggest you're not amazing, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was very different. And David Brooks, who is a columnist in the New York Times, he wrote this article blaming Maslow and Rogers for that movement. And I had David Brooks on my podcast and I confronted him about that. And I said, oh, hell no, David. Like, you know, don't be dissing my boy like that. You know, Abraham.
How did he take it?
He was very gracious. And he said, and I explained to him why, you know, I didn't think that that was fair. And he was like, oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, so.
So what is, what is good kind of self-esteem then as a healthy Maslow self-esteem. Or a Carl Rogers? Healthy self-esteem. Yeah. What does that look like? Where does that come from? So, is that what we're seeing now, or are we seeing a more kind of malign form of self-esteem?
Well, I think we're seeing a lot of what researchers call vulnerable narcissism these days, not healthy self-esteem at all.
Let's get to that in a second. What's good self-esteem?
I answered the last part of your question when I should have just started with the former part. Healthy self-esteem has two components to it. Sense of basic self-worth. It doesn't mean you think you're better than others or you're entitled to anything, just that you are worthy of love. You're worthy of the basic goods of life, of basic needs. You're a worthy person. And also you're a valued social partner to others. And then the second part of healthy self-esteem is the need for mastery or competence, self-competence, some people call it, the sense of self-efficacy, generalized self-efficacy. You basically feel as though you're in control of your life to a certain extent, that you are the driver of your life, that you reach the goals you set out for yourself. You're an agent in this world. You have agency. In this world. So those are the two basic components. Now, the thing is, there's a big difference between self-esteem and narcissism because you see that developmentally as well. So for instance, whereas narcissism tends to peak in adolescence and declines as they get older, usually as testosterone declines, self-esteem tends to be very low in adolescence and tends to increase as we get older. So they actually show mirror images of themselves in terms of the human developmental course. And they also are correlated with very different outcomes in life. And you find that a healthy self-esteem tends to be an emergent outgrowth of real connections with others and real pride, authentic pride in one's mastery.
And can I, because I want to make sure I'm understanding this. So, I mean, in a way, what it is like you're a kid. And you have these kind of fantasies that you know everything or you can control the world through your thinking or your actions. So that's kind of a form of narcissism, which is natural and most people grow out of it. And in terms of self-esteem, hopefully you feel loved because you're in a family or in a social setting where people are like, you know what, we all deserve to be here. We all have basic rights. We all have basic belonging. And then that efficacy or that mastery, you start to develop like, well, I'm not very good at baseball or I'm not very good at math or singing, but I practice and I get better. And as I realize I can develop these skills, I feel better about myself and I take bigger risks or I move into new areas. And I kind of feel like, okay, I don't know the territory exactly, but I can kind of drive around and not get into a wreck every time I start the engine. Is that kind of the distinction we're talking about here?
To a certain extent, yes, I think so. This is where things get a bit hairy, but I'm going to go there because I just love having good faith conversations with you. It's a lot of fun, and I hope our listeners are good faith too. I think that healthy self-esteem really is something that you don't need validation from others. Mm-hmm. It's something that you have a real great inner sense of. So I'm a big fan of the sociometer theory, this idea that we have this sociometer of our self-esteem that in some people it's only tracked based on feelings of self-worth and belonging. So if you don't feel like you're belonging, you know, your sociometer is very low, self-esteem, it constantly changing. There are others that have their sociometer set to I belong regardless of what is going on in the world, you know, and how people treat you to a certain degree. So I think a healthy self-esteem is secure to a certain degree. We can never completely get away from the validations of others, but I think that's really secure. Okay. There are a lot of people that have more of a narcissistic type of. I consider narcissism as just a dysregulated form of the normal need for self-esteem that we all have. It's just an unhealthy regulation of it. It's an attempt to regulate that need in an unhealthy way. So that's how I sort of see narcissism. And what you do is you're having a lot of people who are saying that they're entitled to certain privileges in the world simply because they've suffered, as opposed to because they've earned it, like in a sort of like pride sort of way, like they've done something worthy of pride, right? And certainly some individuals are worthy of that, but I'm saying when you have huge social movements where that's the overall umbrella, is all of us under this umbrella, every single one of us, mm-hmm. is entitled to these privileges because of our trauma, as opposed to because of the great things we've done, you know, mm-hmm. then that's a differentiator between a healthy self-esteem and narcissism. Now I'm going to pause there a second before we get too controversial.
Oh, okay. Because I wanted to immediately get controversial. You know, a lot of this work has kind of in the rearview mirror the genocide, the Nazi genocide of Jews during World War II.
Yeah.
Is it wrong? I mean, coming out of World War II, don't Jews have a claim, not for privileges, but for some kind of recognition of their suffering because of this extreme, you know, fucked up world into which they were thrust absolutely guiltlessly. You know, they were just being killed simply for being born, essentially. So it's not narcissism to say, you know, what people should take. And in the same way, I think with certain elements of in contemporary society, if you're talking about American Indians, talking about, systemic racism against them in the United States, blacks in many ways can make similar claims to say, you know, we have lived under a system of oppression for years. So is that, you know, how does that fit into the, you know, the terms that you were just talking about?
Yeah, I agree that I think there's real things that we can, as a society, can take responsibility mm-hmm. for in making certain injustices right. And mm-hmm. I think that there are people who are very well within their rights to make that clear, you know, we don't feel safe, you know, we don't feel like we're fully mm-hmm. human. And I think that is a very, very good point. I'm trying to think of, you know, let's say that I am good faith about this, and I share the goal that let's say Black Lives Matter movement has. Let's say I'm an ally. I am. Well, not let's say hypothetically. I am an ally in the sense that I share this goal. I think that we can disagree on the methods. You know, we can disagree mm-hmm. on, well, what psychologically speaking, what everything I know about psychology, you know, what can I do to weigh in to help foster intergroup reconciliation? Like if now maybe unless your goal isn't intergroup reconciliation and your goal is to actually just maintain discord forever, you know, then I don't know how to talk to you. But if we do are both good faith, we share this goal of we want to reduce racism, we want to reduce discrimination, you know, like, and that's what we genuinely want. I think from a psychological perspective, the way to go about it is probably, I think a lot of these movements that get in the way of that goal of what they claim that they want, because they're so focused on the grievances and the hostility and the distrust and the cynicism of anyone that even resembles even, like, let's say someone just even as a someone's just white, you know, sometimes you can mm-hmm. see kind of like reverse racism, which I know some people argue that's not such a thing. Some people have argued, you know, within the critical theories movement, they say there's no such thing. You know, your no dominant group can be, you know, but well, I disagree with that. You know, I think that what vulnerable narcissism can look like sometimes is the, you know, treating others the very same way as though they don't want to be, they didn't want to be treated themselves. You know, and discriminating based on someone's skin and, you know, these sorts of things. And so when I see specific instances of that, the humanist in me, the humanistic psychologist in me is like, well, hold up, like that doesn't seem the direction that the goal that we should all have as a society, which is to foster more intergroup reconciliation in ways that would lead to growth. You know, and we want to don't, you know, I would hope that we're all on board with the idea that we want African Americans in our society to be viewed just as fully human as anyone else in our society. I would I would hope that we all share the goal of growth among that group. And so I'm just constantly trying to think, well, what will lead to growth and what will lead to stagnation? And when I see certain thought patterns or behaviors or ways of dealing with others that is looks like stagnation to me, you know, that's when I start to speak up a little bit. And I truly hope people view that in a good faith way, because it really is coming from that place of genuine concern, you know?
So, I mean, is a bad way of dealing with this is something coming out of, you know, Robin DiAngelo's white fragility conception, or of Imram Kendi's, you know, how to be an anti-racist, or how to be anti-racist, where it's a given that there is a totalized system of white supremacy that everybody, including even minorities, who, if they are not actively speaking up against this on every level and in every instance, they are somehow actually implicated or furthering a system. I mean, is that's the type of kind of thought pattern that you're saying it really needs to be challenged, because
particularly that D'Angelo book, which boggles my mind, is like number one in the best bestseller list, New York Times. I had a really great discussion with my class. I'm teaching a class on humanistic psychology, and I have really a great group of diverse, racially diverse students. And so we got a chance to listen to some of the viewpoints of some of the African Americans in my class. And this one African American lady, she outlined her vision of and the work she does, because she goes around trying to explain to white people why this is an issue that they should be an ally about, why they should care. And then the way she framed it to all of us, to the whole class, was wonderful. We all were like on board, and I was, you know, I was almost in a little bit in tears. I was like, you know, this is exactly, you know, there was such a humanist feel to everything she said. And I said, what a contrast with what you just said to like what the D'Angelo way. By the way, D'Angelo's not even African American. She's saying she's going to speak for the whole, you know, everyone. And this is what I see as the key distinction is, people aren't distinguishing between white privilege and white guilt. And I think that we need to treat them as separate things. You know, there's nothing at all. You know, I have no problem admitting, you know, I have all sorts of privileges, and then I also don't have a lot of privilege. I was in special ed as a kid as well. So like, there are lots of things within me that I have and I don't have. And, you know, you think about, you know, for instance, my eye started to, I can't see out of my left eye today for some reason. I woke up with this eye infection. And I was thinking to myself this morning, I was like, what if this is the start of me going blind, you know? And I started to think about, what would my life be like blind? And then I started to do the thought expression. I think, wow, how privileged am I that I can see right now? You know, if I'm going blind, how privileged am I? And you know, I think that we should recognize our privileges more in the sense that it brings us together in a way that brings us together as a human species, because it makes people who are blind feel like we recognize what challenges you might go through. White privilege, I can say that without having white guilt. I have no guilt that I was born with this Jewish white looking face. I have no guilt about that whatsoever. I'm not going to let anyone force me to have guilt for just something I never could have controlled. However, I do fully admit I have white privilege. And all that means is that all else equal, I want to fully acknowledge that there are lots of things of racism that I have not had to experience based on just simply because of the color of my skin. And that's all that means. And so I think these two things have gotten conflated in our society. And you have a lot of very defensive people saying, you know, I don't have white privilege. You don't know me, right? But that's not mm-hmm. what it's about. That's not what white privilege is about. And so we've conflated these things. And then books like D'Angelo just seem sadistic to me. You know, they're like basically saying all white people should self-flagellate themselves, and that's a deficiency motivated realm. Mm-hmm. You know, Maslow distinguishes between the D realm and the B realm. I'm always trying to think, how can we all get to the B realm together? Like, I want us all to get there together, right? And I don't see books like that getting us there. Does that make sense?
I think so, yeah. And, you know, and I guess there's also a question of, you know, some of psychology and some of the humanist psychology, it's about individuals. And when you start to kind of export it to society at large, it becomes complicated, because it is one thing to say, you know, there are certain forms of white privilege that I guess all white people benefit from just by looking a certain way. But then when you layer in class privilege or geographic privilege or gender, everybody has, like, you know, this is to me the interesting, you know, and true part of theories of intersectionality, the idea that we have multiple identities that kind of lay on top of each other and create a different profile for each of us in certain ways. So, you know, a theory that can't take into account a very wealthy, well-connected African-American person who comes from an elite background and measure that against, say, somebody, a poor white person who comes from a very diminished background. If you can't kind of figure out, okay, these are, you can't reduce all of that to black and white, it seems to me, is a bad model, which seems to be a lot of what the anti-racist and white fragility model is exactly trying to do.
Yeah, it's a really good point, and the humanistic psychologist in me would love to just not. I mean, I would obviously love for us not to be such a race obsessed society, you know, right. at all. You know, that we would all just mm-hmm. shift the conversation. You know, but obviously that's a privileged thing to say, right? I mean,
right.
You can't if you're facing discrimination on a daily basis, you can't just move on. And I fully acknowledge that. But I also fully acknowledge, and I think this is something, a point that you made that, or implicit in a point that you made, is that, you know, it's like when we talk in psychology about sex differences, we're talking about averages. And we often try to make the point, well, there's just as much variation within each sex as there is between each sex. And when it comes to, you know, African-Americans, you know, I talk to a lot of African Americans, say, well, this kind of woke ideology doesn't resonate with me at all in my life and my lived experience. I can't resonate with, you know, I'm wondering, how can we open up the space where we mm-hmm. move beyond these, like, reductionism, like, you know, we're going to put everyone who has a certain skin color under a certain umbrella, and this other different skin color, put them under a different mm-hmm. umbrella, and reduce them, all of their humanity, all of their personal experiences, all of their talents, weaknesses, all of the common humanity that we share, and just reduce it to just a hierarchy or ladder of oppression, seems to be antithetical to the whole humanistic ideal.
Right. You have mentioned vulnerable narcissism a couple of times, and that in some of your work or in some conversations, I think, would you say that vulnerable narcissism, and, you know, define it for us, and then is it on the rise, especially among younger people? You know, in this, I don't think they use the same term, but in books like The Coddling of the American Mind, people like Greg Lukianoff and John Haidt kind of talk about a new social type that is developing because of changes in, you know, social media in particular, but other dimensions. So, you know, what is vulnerable narcissism, and is it a broadly emerging social type that we should be concerned about?
Well, I'm looking into that right now. I don't have the answer, because most of the research on generational trends has looked at grandiose narcissism. So,
okay. Explain narcissism.
I'll explain the difference
very quickly. Okay.
So, most people, when they think narcissist, they conjure up probably like Donald Trump or something. Let's be honest. You know, when I see narcissist,
right?
You think the chest thumping, loud, brash narcissist who just takes what they want. But psychologists, even back to the psychoanalysts, noticed what they called the closet narcissist. So other people have called it the covert narcissist, and modern day we call it vulnerable. And now I'm starting to call it the woundable narcissist. I think that's the best phrasing for it, which Nick, you suggested too, right? So this idea that if you think of entitlement as the thing that's in common among all forms of narcissism, that's the thing in the center. There are certain personality moderators that distinguish what flavor, unique flavor of narcissist you are. So entitlement is a thing that's in common among all them. But mm-hmm. if you're a very extreme extrovert, you'll probably be a grandiose type of narcissist if you have the entitlement. If you're very high in a trait called neuroticism, that's when you tend to show more of this quieter form of vulnerable narcissism, where you don't have the agency or extroversion to reach the goals that you want, and that really frustrates you. It really frustrates you because you have these grandiose ideas, mm-hmm. but you're not able to be like this extroverted, narcissist. If you had to be one of the two, I think it's probably better to be a grandiose narcissist. And this, you know, if you want to be a narcissist, let's say like, Scott, I want to be a art narcissist. I would suggest you
make me the best narcissist I can be.
Yeah. Isn't that funny? That's funny, right? Like, yeah. Okay. But there's all sorts of narcissists. This is really interesting because psychologists have discovered there's communal narcissists. So that's mm-hmm. those who have agreeableness trait as the modifier, but also still are a narcissist. They're still of the entitlement. So there are some people who say, I'm the best at helping others. Only mm-hmm. me and me alone can save the world. And they're called communal narcissists. And then you actually tend to find they aren't nearly as effective as they think they are. So they have this grandiosity that outweighs the reality of who they are. So there's communal narcissists, they're vulnerable, grandiose. And then people are starting to look at this in the collective level, like what does collective narcissism look like? So anyway, but just to focus on vulnerable narcissism for a second, if we want to double click on that, it's a fascinating paradox, which is really encapsulated by this idea of, I feel like a piece of shit at the center of the universe. So a lot of people feel that way. Greg Girard, I think, described himself that way, the comedian, you know, right. He's like, I don't understand this paradox my whole life. I feel like I'm a piece of shit at the center of the universe. You simultaneously, usually based on trauma, real victimhood, you feel like you're kind of rotten at the core, but at the same time, you feel entitled to special privileges, and it creates a lot of conflict within the person. It creates
In your book, you talk also about that as being very similar or adjacent to, or I guess the same thing as imposter syndrome, where you are at the center of things and you have great dreams for yourself and expectations, but you also feel you're totally fraudulent.
Yeah, imposter syndrome is interesting because people don't realize that it's often not people who report or they say, I feel like an imposter my whole life. When you dig deeper, you find out it's usually a narcissistic self-presentation strategy that they've done. They don't actually feel like they're an imposter, really, but they use it as a way to manage the expectations of others because it's almost a tactic. Because if you say and you ingratiate yourself in that way and say, you know, I feel like I'm an imposter, if you fail, people will be more sympathetic to you failing.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when you say this, the kind of vulnerable narcissism, and I guess narcissism in general, but vulnerable narcissism comes from trauma. What are the types of trauma? Is it physical abuse? Is it psychological abuse?
All of these things.
Okay.
Emotional
and then is
abuse
it,
is a big
okay.
one.
Okay. Yeah. Can you discuss that a little bit? Because I believe, and I'm looking at the notes I took on the book. An extremely controlling, intrusive, or uncaring parent, or having a parent whose own narcissistic needs are so great that they make the child feel guilty or ashamed for expressing their own needs or expressing their big dreams, which is very normal in childhood, you write. Can you explain the etiology of vulnerable narcissism a little bit more?
First of all, like anything else, there's an interaction between genetic proclivities and environmental stressors. So there are some people who may just have the environmental stressors but don't have the genetic propensities, and they don't interact and they don't develop into vulnerable narcissism. But you can have certain perfect storms where the child shares the vulnerable narcissistic genes with their parents. So they're hypersensitive to the slightest criticism. And then they have a parent who constantly throughout their childhood criticizes them all the time. Mm-hmm. Who you can see how this kind of can brew and not right. be a good combination. It's not a great combination to have terrible genes from your parents and live with your parents your whole life. People don't talk about that from a behavioral geneticist perspective. Like, you know, like it's that interaction that sucks. More so than just having the parent. You know what I mean? Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. No, I mean, as a parent, you know, the thing I think about more as much as anything is, you know, what's that Philip Larkin poem about, you know, your parents will fuck you up, you know, one way or another. And it's like through inherited genes or through the, you know, the social interaction.
Yeah.
But do you think, is there a reason to believe that the kind of vulnerable narcissism, you know, is on the rise? Or how would one test that hypothesis?
Well, I'm definitely looking into it, like I said, and I'm endeavoring on a whole project on that. And I've just started that project. Mm-hmm. So you caught me just at a time where I just want to have full intellectual humility and say that most people have not looked into that question because they've looked at everyone has been focusing on, I think, the red herring. And I really do think that that's true to a certain extent. I think grandiose narcissism has been a red herring because grandiose narcissism has been right in front of our face the whole time. But I think vulnerable narcissism is much more covert and is being rewarded. So I will say I am seeing an increase in it being rewarded on social media as opposed to being seen for what it is as vulnerable narcissism. It's now being weaponized. It's being supported. If you're in a certain in-group, if you're in a powerful in-group, you know, that has a lot of clout and say in society, and you act vulnerably narcissistic within that in-group actually rewards that behavior even more.
Can I put a point on this and say, is that, you know, when students get extremely upset at, you know, real or, and I guess actually more to the point, perceived aggression against them. Is that a, you know, and if it's campuses talking about microaggressions, is it, you know, there's that famous image, you know, which in many ways for kind of campus culture wars is the beginning of something from a few years ago when Nicholas Christakis, who was a professor at Yale, is being screamed at by students for defending his wife, who was also an instructor, and they were kind of resident assistants in a house structure at Yale. You know, we're saying like, you know, students should be able to police themselves on what kind of Halloween costumes to wear and not to be complete dicks about, you know, offending people. And students were screaming at him and saying that he did not make them feel safe there, that he was not doing his job, that he should be fired, that they were ashamed and humiliated to be associated with him. I mean, is that the kind of vulnerable narcissism that you're talking about?
I had to think about if that ticks all the boxes from a clinical perspective. There is there's a connection between vulnerable narcissism and borderline personality disorder. So there's similar cognitions in both of them. One is hostile attribution bias. That's a big one. So I think some of those examples you just mentioned, you do see that. You do see hostile attribution bias as a characteristic thing. I don't think I certainly don't think his wife had negative intentions, had nefarious intentions in writing this seemingly innocuous email saying, well, maybe we should leave it up to the students to choose what costumes they want to wear. Maybe we shouldn't. And then the students perceived, well, this is systemic racism. This is, you know, much, much deeper than what it is. That could be true. But here's something I struggle with, I do struggle with this as just a empathetic human. I think that we somehow need to distinguish between the rise in mental illness and the rise of vulnerable narcissism. You know, there are a lot of students who, like, my heart breaks because they're really stressed out these days. This is why I at Columbia at Barnard, I taught a course on well-being, because I really wanted to do something about this mental health crisis on campus. And I taught these principles in my class, you know, of the right mind, not the right, but the most constructive mindsets, and maybe what were the cognitive distortions you have. And I really have seen up close students, you know, I saw it at Penn as well. There's an idea of Penn face, where you have to put on this, and there were a lot of suicides at Penn when I was there. You have to put on this face that you're, that nothing's wrong, that you're like, you have it all together and you're high achieving. I think we need to really take that seriously and have compassion for the students who are put under immense, immense pressures these days, not just say, oh, they're little snowflakes, you know, because you see how some of the time they're reduced to just snowflakes. Sure. So I think that, you know, in this discussion, we should have that level of compassion and nuance where we distinguish between that, but also can talk about some of these outsized examples, these extreme examples where you do see them on college campuses. Like, I think the Christakis one is a good example. I also think Brett Weinstein and what happened to him and his wife, Heather Hying, is another very good example.
Evergreen College.
Yeah, at Evergreen. Yeah, I mean, they were hunted, you know, like, you know, and that's definitely a level of hostility and antagonism that starts to approach the vulnerable narcissistic realm for sure.
And I think whether it is, you know, part of borderline personality disorder or vulnerable narcissism, that the, you know, the negative attribution,
hostile attribution,
hostile, thank you, a much better term for it, because anybody that you're talking to, you always interpret whatever they say in the most negative, harsh, awful way possible. That seems to be almost the stock and trade of every aspect of American culture right now, which and
you're not wrong.
As you were suggesting, I mean, it makes it very difficult for people who don't already disagree or, you know, with each other to have any kind of interaction, because you assume the other person is full of it. You assume they're going to attack you, or they're kind of working you on some level to get more dirt. It creates a real, I mean, it's there because of a lack of trust, and then it just furthers that even more. So, which brings us back to Transcend, your book, The New Science of Self-Actualization. You know, one of the things that I find really interesting, and particularly from a specifically libertarian point of view, I think anyway, or at least the way that I in my personal kind of gestalt, I think about libertarianism and about human potential, you know, there's the idea that you're an individual, and you're never an individual in isolation from people. In fact, you know, everything that libertarians love, things like free markets and free expression, that's all a way of communicating with people around you, not kind of walling yourself off on a separate island or anything. But there's the idea of the individual, and you have agency and consciousness, and you're trying to perfect yourself, you know, or move in a better direction, gain more mastery, do something interesting and meaningful and something prideful with your life. So you have that, and then you have the kind of ways in which you can actually fulfill that potential. You have mentioned to me that Abraham Maslow was a classical liberal. Does that mean? And is there, you know, I'm not saying all of these things are the same or anything, but it seems to me there's a fertile intersection or valley between kind of human potential, kind of Maslow self-actualization and kind of libertarian thing.
There's a natural connection there that I wanted to talk to you about, because quite frankly, never thought about libertarianism before I met you. You introduced me to that way of thinking. And so I've been really thinking about that, because when I read Maslow's personal diaries, which I did, and he was very, very critical of the war protesters, those who protested in Vietnam, the kids. He thought they were very childish. He thought that they lacked ideas for what it actually would take to make the world a better place. It's funny. I think that if he were alive today, he would be against the woke idea. I could really see Abraham Maslow being against the woke ideology. I could see him being very centrist in a way. Also, very much against the far right, but in his writings, because he wanted to create a humanitarian politics, a humanistic politics. Hmm. And I write in my book what that would look like, just from some of his unpublished readings. I try to flesh that out a bit. Mm-hmm. I think I'm with him. I am with him on this idea that we need to balance, society needs to balance growth and security. So we need to have a good balance of the two. So if society falls too much into all we care about is law and order, we neglect mm-hmm. our higher possibilities. We neglect, you know, hope, you know, a ways forward as a species, ways that we can self-actualize. But if we focus too much on self-actualization, or we focus too much on the individual potential, we neglect those who are being marginalized or oppressed mm-hmm. and don't even get those opportunities. So I just think we need to have this really good balance. And I see that in a lot of ways as a classical liberal approach, is that kind of nuanced call for some for less radicalism in a sense mm-hmm. of one extreme or the other.
Yeah, you talk in one chapter about how conservatives and liberals actually kind of complement each other. And in a sense, if you want the ability to innovate and the ability to experiment, but you also want the a kind of knowledge and respect for tradition and kind of social institutions that have, you know, that exist.
Yes. Was there a question there?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm following up, kind of putting some meat on the bones. And
I agree.
But then that is always, you know, I mean, that implies an ongoing negotiation about, you know, that, I mean, that is what society is, right? It's the outcome of an ongoing, you know, kind of pull and, you know, tug and pull of, you know, people saying we should be moving in this direction. No, we shouldn't, et cetera, and things like that.
Well, but I wanted to hear your thoughts on libertarianism and and its connection to classical liberalism.
Yeah, I mean, it's, well, you know, libertarians, I think, oftentimes will use classical liberal as another way of talking about libertarianism. I think there is a more kind of doctrinaire, dogmatic form of libertarianism, which you know, is kind of a checklist where there's maybe 10, you know, here are 10 policy positions. And if you don't agree with all 10, then you're a communist or you're a fascist. So just get the hell out, as opposed to a more general sensibility, which in many ways, you know, and this is somebody like the Austrian born economist Friedrich Hayek is famous for, of kind of talking about how almost like Marx, but that individuals make history, but not necessarily under conditions of their own choosing, but that you need to be respectful of the past, but also have freedom from it and to push into new ways and to remake institutions. And in many ways, it's a non-radical. It's more of an evolutionary kind of philosophy of society as well as politics, rather than a kind of French Revolution.
It's not a revolutionary approach. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And it's not a reactionary approach. That's equally important. That, you know, Franco Spain is on the one hand a terrible place to live, but so is revolutionary France. And that what you want is a system in which individuals and the groups they form can experiment and try out new ways of living, new ways of creating meaning, new ways of doing business or creating art, and in a decentralized way, so that you can see kind of what works and either adapt it yourself or hybridize it and come up with something that is like it but different and works for you.
Well, yes. And I mean, I think towards Maslow's later couple of years of his life, he was really positing the need for transcendence in society. He was really a big fan mm-hmm. of the Bodhisattva path to enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, you know, can you be a libertarian and take the Bodhisattva path to enlightenment? Has anyone ever asked you that question before?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's like, explain what you mean by the Bodhisattva path, because that is the saint who remains among us. Is that right?
It's the one who feels like they've never really actualized themselves unless they help bring others to enlightenment as well.
Right.
You know, that there really is a deep responsibility that the person takes for the good society which Maslow right. used that phrase a lot. And I was just wondering, is that incompatible with libertarianism?
I don't think it's incompatible. There are certain types of certain strains within libertarian thought, you know, and I think of somebody like Ayn Rand, who is posited as, you know, an arch individualist and whose yeah. heroes in her novels, as well as kind of the, you know, the Ubermensch in her philosophy, is very individualistic. And there's not a lot of talk about, you know, helping the little guy and stuff like that. Although even implicit in her, there is a sense that what happens with in a free market oriented society, and by that it's not simply about economics, but it's one where power and opportunity is decentralized and is dispersed throughout the system. That you know the businessman, for instance, you know somebody like a Steve Jobs or a Bill Gates, who creates a great product that becomes affordable and ubiquitous to everyone, gives everybody more opportunities to actualize themselves, and that so that. From a left-wing perspective, commerce is often seen as exploitative, and it's, you know, it's taking the poorest people in the world and exploiting them for the benefit of people who are already rich and actualized. I think most libertarians would argue, and I think they're correct in this, of saying that, in fact, you know, people, great inventors who tend to profit in the marketplace are doing that because they're giving more people more means by which they can live lives as they see fit. And that's a powerfully communitarian model. It's you know, libertarian thought or libertarianism is not about the individual. The individual is always the unit of measurement and, you know, needs to have as much autonomy as possible. But that's because that's how society itself flourishes. I don't know if that
thank you for
convinces you or
it doesn't fully convince me, but I really. Like, I wanted to just listen to you. I just wanted to hear your thoughts on it, because it's I want to start formulating some really more articulate, maybe even write some articles on this. So I really appreciate
this. There is that question of, you know, when we started talking and you were talking partly about, you know, the goals of Black Lives Matter being widely shared. And then there's a question of
the methods.
I think about this a lot. Somebody like Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize winning economist who is identified as libertarian, his idea behind school choice, and particularly vouchers, of giving individual students money to spend however they or their parents saw fit, is, you know, simultaneously it's very individualistic, and it's also the whole goal behind that. And he recognized that the state could effectively support education and give people who otherwise had no means and ability to participate in society in a way that they would not be able to. I think in a lot of ways, you know, everybody who's in favor of public education or universal education would say that's one of the points of education. And then you kind of get hung up over, well, does a traditional, you know, centralized school district using taxpayer money, you know, from a centralized place that goes to a particular school, is that more effective, or is devolving the funding mechanism to the individual student? You know, these are ultimately our debates over means, not ends. So, you know, there's something to think about with that too. You know?
Yes, that is really interesting, because I feel like people are so focused in in this political battlefield where everyone's ripping each other apart. It seems like everyone's focusing on the means,
absolutely,
and we're not connecting on the common humanity of our agreement on the ends.
Right.
And I see that as like a major core problem of the political landscape right now, right?
Which is certainly highly polarized and given to angry, ugly expression of sentiment, you know, and it's not invented by social media. It's probably helped along by it to a certain degree. But also, you know, as a final kind of topic of conversation, and to talk about, you know, transcending things, Scott, can we talk a little bit about, you know, for the past 6 months now, you know, everybody pretty much around the globe, but certainly in the United States, and you've lived in New York and LA, you know, most recently, so you can, you know, bicoastal during the COVID era, as have I been. But What does something like a coronavirus lockdown, where, you know, we're facing a disease that nobody quite understands fully, where our day-to-day lives have been completely changed? You know, there was somebody flipped a switch and you couldn't go to movie theaters, you couldn't go to Broadway plays, you couldn't go to school, you couldn't go to work. It's just things really topped up. How, you know, you are the author of Transcend, the New Science of Self-Actualization. How do you, you know, what are the best ways or the most constructive ways for people to respond to this kind of hardship and maintain or even expand their humanity?
It's tough. You know, part of it is acknowledging that we're all suffering right now and that it's okay to suffer. It's like okay to, sometimes you don't have to do anything about it. Sometimes, like if you have a feeling of rage, you have a feeling of intense anxiety. I think that both me and you the other day shared to each other that we're both feeling this low level, constant sense of anxiety that just won't go away. And we don't need to make it go away. It's there for a reason. Mm-hmm. I think that part of that is having the acceptance of it and having the self-compassion that, you know, it's happening for a reason. But the humanistic psychologist in me, the positive psychologist, really wants to move us individually and as a collective towards this post-traumatic growth aspect of the field, where we realize that we don't have to be defined by the coronavirus. I mean, I know that it's the only thing that anyone's ever talking about on the news, and it is horrible. So many people are dying. But we can look at this moment in our life as an amazing, amazing opportunity to prioritize once and for all. Like, we've never had that moment before in our life. Prioritize the things that really matter to us, the things that we've taken for granted before. We've been given a gift to a certain degree, because we've also obviously been given, right? Like, I'm not trying to completely change this, but is there any law saying we're not allowed to see this as partly a gift for our own lives to be able to take the needed pause that maybe we'd been going a certain direction our whole life without ever taking any stock on it, we've been taking for granted lots of things. And, you know, with the full hope that we live through that the person doing that reflecting is not going to get sick and die, and you have the rest of your life to, this will pass, this too will pass, you know, assuming that, how can we move towards post-traumatic growth?
Yeah, you in the book you talk, and part of it is, which is very revelatory for me, was, you know, going the way that you go through Maslow's late writings, his diaries, a lot of unpublished stuff, but he had an experience where he had a heart attack, I guess, 2 or 3 years before he died, and that heart attack, you know, and again, I mean, it sounds almost cliched, and to the extent that it is, it's because of Maslow's influence, but he took a near-death experience as, you know, not as a reason to give up or to lose hope, but rather that was, you know, it kind of focuses attention on, you know, what he really thought about and what he wanted to accomplish.
That was I should have made that link. I'm so glad you did. His postmortem life is the kind of life that we can live now. He argued that the past couple of years after that first heart attack, he said, I'm living a postmortem life. You know, everything, you know, here now is gravy, in the sense that, like, it's all plus because I'm still alive after this. And he said he was developing some exercises to help people get a postmortem. He said, if I can assure you that you will live a dignified death, that you will you overcome this fear of death that's constantly hanging over your head, you know, this day and every day forevermore for the rest of your life will change. Everything will change. And I think that there is a way in which we can frame this situation. I mean, look, if Viktor Frankl in the concentration camps could find meaning and joy, we under COVID can find some meaning and joy. And we don't need to feel guilt for finding meaning and joy just because it's such a terrible situation, right? We can help others. Yeah. I mean, this is maybe libertarian, I'm going to say, but we can simultaneously do what we can to reduce the spread. I mean, put on the damn mask, you know, do what you can to help others, but at the same time, you know, use this as an amazing opportunity to grow yourself.
All right. We are going to leave it there. I have one final question for you, Scott Barry Kaufman, though, which is you're also the creator and host of the Psychology Podcast, which is a fantastic podcast. Where's the best place people should go to get that?
You can just go to thepsychologypodcast.com or iTunes, Spotify. Mm-hmm. It's on all these platforms.
The whole thing. This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. We have been talking with Scott Barry Kaufman, the author most recently of Transcend, the New Science of Self-Actualization. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you, Nick. This is great.